Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel Wu, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is the Pacific Division off-season in review, season preview episode. I was really happy to have Jack Winner and Seth Partnow. You can read Jack at Dime Magazine. He is there now full-time. And you can read Seth at Clipper Blog, Hoop365, and the Hardwood Paroxysm Network, among a lot of other places. And I wanted to have them on because they both have a connection with the area and with the division. And we start out with the offseason, who got better, who got worse, particular transactions. And then we get into a season preview, ranking the teams, who's going to make the playoffs and everything. It was a really fun conversation. Ran for about an hour, 7 minutes, so it's a hearty dialogue. We go on a lot of topics from the Clippers change in ownership to what's going on with the Warriors, with coaching and everything else, and Klay Thompson, Kevin Love. And we hit all the teams. We talk in depth. When you have a little over an hour, you can really do that with only five teams. So it was a pleasure having them on, and I hope you enjoy it too. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having the group.
Me, us, the group. Yeah, it's good to be here. I think the last time you and I talked, Danny, just right before the playoffs or the finals, maybe. Yes, it was the finals, actually, because I remember I predicted Spurs Heat to go seven, and I just had no idea what was going to happen. And obviously that proved visual thinking, but... all of a sudden we're like 6 weeks from the start of the season, and thank God.
Yeah, as much as I wanted to love the FIBA tournament, it just never got that sizzle for me, which was a little bit disappointing.
I tried, and I really, really tried to get into it, and I was for a little bit, and then kind of the wind was taken out of my sails once Spain lost, and it became evident that Team USA was just going to run through the knockout round, but I guess that's kind of how it goes in FIBA play.
Okay, so we'll get started, and this is the Pacific Division Review Preview, and I like to start with the off-season interview. First question is, who do you think got better, and who do you think got worse in the division?
As far as got better, I'm not sure anyone did, really. Maybe the Warriors, just by virtue of, I wasn't a fan of Mark Jackson's, specifically his kind of offensive scheming, and adding Sean Livingston kind of fills a big void there, so... The Warriors, maybe. Other than that, I think Phoenix possibly got worse. I think Sacramento didn't improve as much as they might. The Lakers are still kind of a mess. And the Clippers, I'm not sure they got better. I don't think they got worse, but I think that they're kind of held steady, more or less.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Seth here in that there wasn't a team that took one huge step forward or even one huge step back, though. I think I'm a little higher on the Warriors this season than you are, Seth, just in comparison to last year. And it's pretty much because of what you said, the coaching switch from Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr. Danny and I have talked about this ad nauseum. People in the Bay Area love to talk about it. Just how stagnant and really underachieving the Warriors were under Mark Jackson. I think they ranked 13th in offensive efficiency last year. And given the talent they have on hand and really how transcendent an offensive player Steph Curry is, they should be doing far better than 13th in offensive efficiency. And Kerr has really stressed that his system, while some of it will be triangle based, he'll be mostly about continuity and putting Steph in a lot of pick and rolls and really, really putting the ball in his hands. Compared to how stagnant the offense was under Jackson, I think the Warriors are bound to improve there. And then defensively, adding Sean Livingston and even Brandon Rush, who I'm really high on, assuming he's healthy. The Warriors should be just as good as they were last season. But in terms of who took a step back, Phoenix, I think definitely. Who knows what's going to go on with Eric Bledsoe? I'm of the opinion, and it seems obvious now, that he'll be in Phoenix this season. But the mental aspect that, all the contract conversations and all that has, who knows what's going to happen there. And then they lost Channing Frye, which I think is huge too. And then just one more thing. The Sacramento Kings and Darren Collison, I think we're all, I haven't talked to you guys about this before, I think we're all in agreement there that that's a huge step back from Isaiah Thomas, and really just vexing. I have no idea what they were thinking.
I mean, they were thinking that Darren Collison is a quote-unquote true point guard, which I've written a fair few things this summer, just kind of going through almost any way you look at it, that's just, you know, kind of false. And to the extent that Isaiah Thomas is a more of a shoot-first point guard, it's because Isaiah Thomas is good at shooting, and that's a good thing. So it's just it's a clear downgrade, and for the difference in the money that Thomas got from Phoenix versus what they're paying Collison, it's frankly kind of mystifying.
Yeah, agreed completely. I followed Collison a long time because we went to college together, and he's not a pass-first point guard. He never has been. He's benefited a lot from what I call greatness proximity. He's been next to good players, and he's played well in spot minutes, so people think that he's better than he is. But he wasn't even a pass-first point guard when he was in college, and it's crazy that he's somehow gotten that reputation and the reputation as a defensive stopper when he was a disaster in the Clippers-Warriors series last year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was on a Clipper blog live with you, Seth, and we talked about Collison's just awful defensive performance. Yeah, I'm not sure where that's come from. Obviously, he's a very, very good athlete. He's just fast as hell, very quick. And he can be disruptive on the ball on occasion, but he's just so small, and he gets lost off the ball far, far too frequently. And like you said, Danny, he's really not a true point guard at all. So, and for 3 years and $15 million, you know, I really don't understand it at all.
There were two other teams that I wanted to talk about a little bit, and the first one is the Clippers, because while they didn't add starters, I think that the additions of Spencer Hawes and Ekpe Udo and retaining Glenn Davis will really help them, because their big man rotation last year just had such a big drop-off that having guys there that can capably fill the other minutes is going to probably swing a couple regular season games and maybe a playoff game or two in their favor.
This is a sort of a yes, but for me, yes, that is an, you know, having Spencer Hawes take those minutes away from whether it's, you know, Ryan Hollins or Byron Mullins or anything like that. Yes, that is an improvement. If you look at kind of how the deals all came together, here's where the but comes in. By giving Hawes the full mid-level exception, they put themselves in a position to have to make what was, I think, a pretty horrific trade, which is basically, you know, a first rounder and Jared Dudley for the ability to sign a bunch of minimum guys while still paying the guys they cut over the next couple of years. It's the kind of thing where one move, while it made sense on its own, led into kind of future, I don't want to say mistakes, because from where they were after, you know, signing Hawes and Farmar right up against the luxury tax apron, they maybe had to make some kind of cost-cutting move, but the kind of the first move forcing that a questionable decision-making process. And one of the reasons why, and this is something that I think we've talked about on Clipper Blog Live a few times, Jack, is how Doc Rivers, the GM, not always the best friend to Doc Rivers, the coach.
Yeah, I'd totally agree there. And that's a tough balancing act, you know, for all the guys who occupy that dual role. You know, how do you measure the future versus the present? And I think, you know, like you said, with the Jared Dudley and first round pick trade, that was tough. That was tough. Obviously, you never want to give up a first rounder, but the picks can end up being, you know, mid-20s, late-20s. And Jared Dudley, they really got nothing from him last season. He was one of the biggest disappointments in the league for me. But like you said, Danny, getting back to your original point, I do like what they did with Hawes and Udo. I'm actually higher on Hawes than a lot of people are. You know, who knows whether or not he will turn into. He will stay the long range. He was really a marksman from three-point range with Cleveland last year. He was efficient, but he was also prolific from three-point range, and that really came out of nowhere. So that'll be, if he's able to shoot from three-point range and kind of space the floor for Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, you know, that'll be something the Clippers really lacked. And then Ekpe Udo, obviously, when DeAndre goes off the floor, they've lacked any semblance of rim protection in the past. Udo is obviously, you know, considering what they signed him for, just a veteran's minimum. He's a bit player. But just that shot blocking aspect is something they really lacked once DeAndre went off the floor, and you know, they won't this season.
I'm not as high on Udo. He's a guy who probably, since he's by all accounts a great guy, you know, with the book club and all that kind of stuff, and his original high draft slot, he's a guy whose reputation probably outstrips his ability. I mean, there's a reason he was a guy who was available for a minimum for basically the entire offseason. So while if he can give, you know, 10 minutes of solid rim protection and and Doc can craft lineups around him that give enough offense, then maybe they'll get away with it. But I am less convinced that he will be a difference maker. And again, you know, in a vacuum, a worthwhile gamble. Is it a gamble that you're happy about giving up a future first rounder? And just to, if I may back up, you made the point of the first rounder, where it's going to fall. The problem wasn't so much that it's going to be a massively valuable pick. It's just that was kind of their last asset that they could have used.
Right.
Say midseason, they get banged up on the wing, and then they still have, you know, Dudley's contract and that first rounder to go after, you know, someone who can, you know, be productive in that spot at a medium range contract, instead of now their team is their team and there's nothing, no other moves they can really make. And I'm not sure that for a team that's a contender like the Clippers, that being done in August is, or early September is necessarily ideal.
They also sold incredibly low on Jared Dudley. It's hard to imagine that his stock would have stayed as bad as it was right now. So I understand the urgency with the hard cap. That's something that I've talked about a lot in various parts of the internet. But they really did that. And the other part of it that was so shocking to me is that they weren't able to do it as a straight-up dump, that they had to take on these salaries in Miroslav and Carlos Delfino, because it seems like the Sixers and Jazz were just sitting there, and they could have just dumped the contract on them if they were willing to give up a first and just do it that way, as opposed to spending this money and be using the stretch provision to tie up a little bit of cap space the next couple of years.
I've been told by people in the know, I believe it was I was talking with Mark Deeks, and sorry, Mark, if I have that wrong, but the Sixers were asking for two firsts for this deal. So, I mean, maybe it was the best they could get, especially considering that the teams could look at the cap sheet and see that, you know, they can't even invite any non-rookies to training camp without making this kind of move. So they kind of, the Clippers kind of, again, with the signings of Farmer and Hawes and Glenn Davis, kind of put themselves in a position to give any trading partner the leverage. And that's why the deal kind of came out the way it did. And you touched on something, by the way, that I thought was strange, which is why they decided to stretch Radulica. You know, if big man depth is a thing, performed, you know, pretty decently in a tiny sample size for Milwaukee last year. Why does it have to be him or Udo? Why not both? Why Hedo Turkoglu instead? I didn't necessarily understand the desire to, you know, pay dead money the next 5 years to be able to get in another minimum guy for this year.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And the other team I want to talk about in this section, and we'll move on, is I was frustrated, though I understood why the Lakers went with all these short-term moves, considering we all know that they're going to probably be terrible this year. Did you understand, you know, they got a first-rounder for Jeremy Lin, so I get that. That's a decent move, even though it cost them a ton of money. But Boozer and kind of those little small moves that are very short-term.
It's the Boozer one that I really don't understand at all. I don't want to say I don't understand it, because I do understand it. They want to remain somewhat competitive here in Kobe's twilight, just so they aren't winning, you know, 20 games and they might win 34 instead. I'm not sure that Carlos Boozer is the guy that's, you know, going to get you 6 or 7 wins. And, you know, that's one point. And the bigger issue is the Lakers aren't a team that should be, you know, trying to win 37 games and sniff the playoffs and, you know, the most competitive conference maybe in league history. They should be tanking, basically, to try and find that elusive superstar. But, you know, because of where Kobe is in his career and how much he means to the franchise, you know, they're kind of hamstrung by his current circumstances. And like I said about Boozer specifically, his signing inhibits the growth of Julius Randle. How much is he going to play, you know, now that Carlos Boozer's aboard? It's very strange to me. And it's really a shame, because the Lakers had an opportunity this season after missing out on the big name free agents to kind of think ahead. And instead, they just kept thinking in the present. And I think it's going to set them back for a while.
As the kids on Twitter like to say, RIP, you're mentioned for being that down the Lakers. But yeah, no, I agree with all that. And, you know, the weird thing about the Boozer situation is that they have a ton of, you know, young bigs, especially, you know, picking up Ed Davis. Ryan Kelly was surprisingly non-terrible last year, and he's going to get buried this year. And it's the situation where, you know, Boozer is while they might have got a quote good deal on him, that's not because of the way the amnesty stuff works. He's not really an asset for them because they can't trade him.
Right.
So it's not the kind of thing where it's not a situation where they can, you know, refurbish an old house and then get something for it. Whereas, you know, if they were giving minutes to, you know, an Ed Davis or Ryan Kelly or something like that, then and a contender came calling, then maybe they could, you know, turn that someone who wasn't necessarily in their long-term plans into something to build for the future. And they've kind of, you know, eliminated that as an option for themselves because now they're going to be, you know, playing Carlos Boozer 30 minutes a game, which, you know, he's a productive player and probably underrated actually as a player, just because he's got such a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've said, he's not a guy who's going to drag them to 40 wins on his own. So that was mystifying. I like the Lynn pickup for them, but still it's how are the pieces going to fit together in anything resembling, I don't want to say a good team, but anything resembling a team that even makes sense as building toward something. And that's, you know, the thing hanging over this whole conversation is, of course, the silly extension they gave Kobe, which, you know, prevents anything really meaningful for happening that for them for the lifespan of that contract. So, you know, what could they have done? But at the same time, they probably could have done more in terms of setting themselves up for the post-Kobe era than they did.
Yeah, just one more very puzzling thing I want to mention about the Lakers is that they gave Nick Young a 4-year, $21 million contract. For 2017-2018, Nick Young is going to make $5.7 million. It's a player option. He'll be 33 years old. The athleticism and the kind of fluidity and the coordination that makes him a somewhat effective NBA player will certainly be diminishing when he's 33 and making nearly $6 million a year. In 2018, it was baffling. I like watching, I'm using air quotes. I like watching Swaggy P as much as the next guy, but you know, and he's fun and, you know, he's a draw and, you know, he has merit on a certain team, on a contending team, or he's the seventh or eighth guy and he'll maybe come off the bench for some instant offense, but certainly not at that price tag and certainly not for these Lakers.
I think he has merit for a really bad team too, just in terms of entertainment value.
Right.
But then again, if you know, as you said, those last 2 years when they're hoping to no longer be really bad, like what's the point? The per year figure on the Jordan Hill contract, he was at 9.5, is, you know, that's a little bit of sticker shock, but that's a much better contract than Nick Young has.
Certainly.
Because 2 years and done, and okay, you overpaid him for 2 years. But they're 2 years that, so what, to some extent, versus, you know, Nick Young, like, as you said, you're going to be, you know, using $5 million a year of cap space on a guy who you hope isn't in your rotation by that point.
Yeah, and they even have a team option on Jordan Hill for that second season,
yeah.
So he's basically an expiring. I was just as confused by that contract when I saw the initial number, 2 years, 18, and then I saw it was a team option. That makes far more sense than Nick Young's. I'm so confused by it.
And the other part of the whole thing is that they spent all this money on those guys, and then another guy went from one team in this division to another team in Isaiah Thomas, who would have actually made sense with this team. And the bigger issue that I have with the Lakers is thinking about what they have in terms of assets. So basically, who will guys want to play with? Because they're going to have to bring in new talent. Even if they draft well, they're still going to have to bring in other talent. And Carlos Boozer is going to be gone, and I don't think guys are particularly keen on playing with him. Jeremy Lin's probably going to be gone. So they added in, and Hill, who knows, but so they added in all these pieces that are hard to move and that aren't going to be there. So you're not selling future players on these are the guys that you're going to play with. And that's why I think a guy like Isaiah Thomas would have made a lot of sense for the Lakers, especially because they could have traded him at the price he ended up signing for.
I think they're banking on the Lakers being the Lakers. You know, we are the Lakers. Everyone wants to play with us. You know, Kevin Love is coming, and you know, a middle of last season, you kind of got the little ridiculous jokes of their, you know, their starting lineup for this coming season being like Rajon Rondo, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Love, Carmelo Anthony, and somebody else. And you know, it's a little bit of picking low hanging fruit, having a little fun with over exuberant Laker fan, but still, I think to some extent that sort of confidence that it'll always work out because we're the Lakers. underpins some of these moves, and maybe with a bit more competence in the front office of the Clippers, that's not necessarily the case, especially, you know, when, as we're getting demonstrated to us kind of year after year, that Jim Buss is not Jerry Buss, and that matters. So, you know, the confidence that, you know, people always want to come and play with us because we're the Lakers, and with all that entails, I think that's lessening, and if it's not almost gone by now. So, and that, again, that's their confidence that they don't need these guys people want to play with, because it's the Lakers people want to play for is their pitch. And that's less true than it used to be, I think.
Yeah, and as you alluded to, Seth, I think a lot of the kind of Lakers losing their luster in the free agent market has to do with, you know, the Clippers ascending. And, you know, after the Donald Sterling fiasco, all his reprehensible really thoughts and actions here over the last, I don't know how many decades, and there's no reason to rehash that again, but the Clippers are in as good a spot as they've been in quite some time. Even after the, you know, kind of strange offseason that we just discussed, you know, they're certainly a Western Conference contender. And, you know, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin are superstars. DeAndre Jordan is kind of he's obviously a very, very good player. But he's also a niche favorite for fans. People love what he does. And they're an exciting team. And as they continue to ascend, it only makes sense that the shine would kind of wear off on the Lakers. And I think that's what we're seeing when it comes to free agency.
And the other factor in this, and this is something we could talk about briefly, is I thought about this, and I might have talked about it with Jack about a year ago, but the idea that I had was that there was this strange situation where none of the major market teams, so meaning New York and LA, had a combination of good ownership and good front office people. You know, each team had a flaw somewhere. And what the Clippers did by making this move is they might be the first team to have both, though we obviously have issues with Doc Rivers, the GM. Their overall front office picture plus ownership now is probably the best of the four New York and LA teams.
It's hard to argue with that of the four. This is, I mean, thinking about, you know, what a mess that Brooklyn's going to be. I mean, they're that's a really good point. Though at the same time, it's going to take, you know, a decade of that kind of differential for it to LA to actually become a Clippers town. I think that's fair to say that the Lakers will be the first team in LA still, but that is more from a fan perspective than a where do I want to go to play perspective. I mean, do I want to win a championship? Do I want to play with other good players? Do I want to play for a quality organization? Those questions right now are pointing towards the Clippers as you know, the place to go.
Certainly, and it's interesting that we haven't even discussed the hiring of Byron Scott as the coach of the Lakers. I think that's kind of telling that we haven't mentioned that yet, just because that just doesn't move the needle one iota in a positive direction. I almost just think he's a placeholder and someone that can just play Kate Kobe here over the final 2 years of his career. You know, after some great success in New Orleans and New Jersey early, Byron Scott really hasn't done anything good. And, you know, he was a confusing hire to me. And, you know, just another strange aspect of the Lakers offseason.
It's, again, it's kind of he's a former Laker. So it's trying to, you know, capture some of that luster that of, you know, the Showtime team, which, you know, that's a fond memory at this point and doesn't do much for today's player or fan. And I think it's funny because as much as Mike D'Antoni got the blame for everything last year, I'm wondering how long it will be into this season before we start to people start to, you know, have that, you know, Mike D'Antoni, at least we were entertaining last year kind of stuff going on. So that's that. I was not a particular fan of that hire, but as you say, it's a placeholder because who wanted that job? Really, it's not a job that lends itself to success right now.
Yeah. So we'll move on to and who you think is going to be the best newcomer to his team in this from this offseason.
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, because like we said, there really isn't any huge signings other than Isaiah Thomas, and you know because they're so stacked at point guard, you know, who really knows what's going to happen there. So, but I'd have to say him. I'd have to say Isaiah Thomas because we've seen that Jeff Hornacek certainly isn't afraid to play two point guards. And if Eric Bledsoe's situation is so contentious, you know, that his play suffers in the court or, you know, he becomes a locker room distraction or anything like that, you know, then they'll be relying on him for huge minutes, not just big minutes off the bench. So I really love the Isaiah Thomas acquisition for the Suns, especially at the price. 4 years, $28 million, is an absolute bargain for a player of his caliber. And he's really just a perfect fit for what they do and how they space the floor, and they just go all the time. They constantly run pick and roll. He's a great fit there. And I also really like the acquisition of Sean Livingston for the Warriors. You know, he's a guy that he certainly rebuilt his career with Brooklyn last season after that devastating injury from, I think, 2006 or 2007. It's so great to see him doing well, but he occupies a certain type of player for the Warriors that they lacked last season in a secondary ball handler, a guy that can take some pressure off of Steph Curry, you know, in terms of playmaking duties other than Andre Iguodala. And that's just huge. He's obviously not a floor spacer, but the Warriors have all the floor spacing they need with, you know, Clay and Steph. And defensively, he's very, very solid. So I really like that signing, but Isaiah Thomas is probably the biggest one.
I think that Livingston is going to prove to be the more impactful signing, assuming health, of course, just because, as you said, Thomas is sort of, that was a nice asset acquisition move, but he's kind of duplicative of a lot of what the Suns already did. So, I mean, his production is probably going to be more along the lines of just kind of replacing what Dragic or Bledsoe would have done in those same minutes and opportunities. So while that's certainly from a going forward, what do we have to work with standpoint, that was obviously a huge coup. On the floor, I think Livingston, for the reasons you mentioned, is going to be probably the more impactful signing or acquisition. And, you know, one thing you kind of alluded to was Livingston's ability to playmake. And, you know, we talked about this a little earlier in terms of the Warriors' kind of stagnant offense last year. One of the interesting things, looking through some of the new data that we've gotten last year, was the Warriors threw the fewest passes per game of any team in the league by a sizable margin. Now, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything just because, you know, you can throw the ball around the perimeter and not do anything, or you can make a really impactful pass. But I think that kind of encapsulates kind of the stagnant nature, the kind of the very mid-90s feel of Mark Jackson's offense. And Livingston is a guy who's going to, you know, he's going to move the ball. He's going to draw an extra defender in the post and throw a pass. He's going to make the extra pass quickly. And with the, you know, the overall passing talent on that team, moving the ball more is only a good thing, I think. And he kind of fits in well with Kerr's stated desire to get more ball and player movement.
You mentioned Livingston and post-ups, and he was in a fantastic post-up player for Brooklyn last year. One of the best in the league, I think the metrics say. But the last thing I want to do is encourage anyone in the Warriors front office or coaching staff to go down to the block with a wing. I think we all saw what that did for the Warriors in the last 2 years with Clay and Andre Iguodala and Harrison Barnes.
But the Warriors will have space to do that because they have Kevin Love stretching the floor from the four position.
Oh.
Yeah, I was gonna make a joke that I want to do this as an alternative history podcast and have my best offseason acquisition be Kevin Love, but we can't really do that. So what I would go with is actually, it's a little bit cheating, but I don't think so, is to go off of what Seth said and say the biggest acquisition isn't a player, but it's Steve Kerr. Because he will make a bigger difference for what this Warriors team could be than any addition to any of the other ones. Because I also think that he'll be a part of this team for a longer period of time because they have the long-term commitment to him and he's chummy with the owner, and that's always a good thing for job security.
I will mildly disagree, just because if Kerr works out the way that you know people hope he will, that's true. I don't think that we can really make those kind of pronouncements about a guy who's never coached before, being such a, you know, that impactful. It's pretty hard for, you know, a coach to be a very positive impact on a team. It's actually pretty hard for a coach to be a, you know, if someone is good enough to get hired as an NBA coach, most NBA coaches are kind of right in the middle where their teams perform about how their team is supposed to perform. I mean, you've got, you know, your Popovich, your Carlisle, and maybe one or two others on one end, and then, you know, the churn of the worst coaches in the league at the other end. But other than that, most guys are pretty good at some things, not so good at other things, and it all kind of comes out in the wash. And we don't know enough about Kerr to say that he's going to be one of those guys, those you know, Popovich, Carlisle, I think Eric Spoelstra, Stan Van Gundy are the other guys I'd have kind of mm-hmm. in that top echelon. I don't think we it's just way too early to say. You know, we're talking about former players being coaches. I almost wonder if Derek Fisher is going to be a more impactful coach than Steve Kerr, but that's a whole other discussion, I think.
Certainly, and Kerr, at the very least, has said all the right things about the offense. You know, and like I mentioned earlier about how they're going to run a lot of pick and roll, really put the ball in Steph's hands, a lot of motion. You know, while implementing some triangle aspects, but you know, the fact that it came out once it became clear the Warriors weren't going to part with Klay in a potential Kevin Love trade, it came out that Kerr and Jerry West were the biggest proponents of keeping Klay. That doesn't necessarily speak very, very well to me of his evaluation and, you know, and really, you know, what he thinks this team is capable of. The Warriors, you know, they're a very good team, you know, but they're not in that upper echelon group of championship contenders, you know, like the San Antonio Spurs, like the Thunder, perhaps, you know, like the Clippers. They're on that level below. And if they had Kevin Love, you know, perhaps that might be different. But Kerr, for whatever reason, you know, decided Klay, they couldn't part with him. And, you know, that's certainly something to think about, you know, when assessing how well we think Kerr is going to do in his first season.
So that's a great point. And we'll move on to who you think, and we're not going to do this on who you think is going to be the best rookie, but who you are most excited to see play in the NBA.
I was really, really big on Nick Stauskas coming into the draft just because he's obviously an incredibly gifted shooter. He's, you know, one of the 10 or 15 best shooters in the league, I'd say, just right now. But he's very, very underrated as a playmaker. He does some good stuff off the dribble. I think eventually you'll be able to run some pick and roll with him, and he'll be able to do some things that, you know, a secondary ball handler can really do. And in the draft process, you know, people really didn't look at him that way, think of him as a standstill shooter. But, you know, he's a good athlete. You know, like I said, he can handle the ball. He has some passing knack. He's not long, which is an issue, and I'm kind of concerned about how he will finish in the paint. But I'm excited to see what he does, especially in conjunction or either or with Ben McLemore, because, you know, there's some redundancy there, obviously. But I don't think those two guys necessarily can't play together. I know a lot of people were confused by the Kings selecting Stauskas just after they selected McLemore the year prior. And seeing how those two guys, you know, kind of how the playing rotation susses out between them and whether or not they share court time, that's something I'm looking forward to watching this year.
Certainly, there's a fair amount of pressure on Stauskas just in terms of making ownership look good based on those draft war room videos that came out about that. So I don't know. I like Stauskas for all the reasons you said. He's kind of a confusing selection nonetheless, also because they had just drafted McLemore. And, you know, the fact that he's going to be lucky to be a slightly below average defender, let alone an average right. or better defender in the NBA. You know, I'm interested to see, well, we'll see less of him than we thought we might, but Julius Randle. I was actually very intrigued by Jordan Clarkson in Los Angeles before they acquired Nick Young. He seemed like a guy who could be one of those second-round picks that was, hey, this guy. Especially, you know, in a situation where he's playing on a not-so-good team and would get those opportunities. Again, another guy who wonder if he's going to get the opportunities to justify what was a somewhat surprising selection, followed up by a pretty great summer league, is TJ Warren in Phoenix. But they have so many guys that you wonder if he'll get the playing time and to even prove whether his game will actually translate to the full NBA level. He's kind of the very much a tweener, but whether or not he can be, you know, a tweener in kind of the, to go back a few ways, the Cedric Ceballos mold, who can figure out ways to score even so, or if he's just going to be one of those kind of the Derek Williams types who isn't big enough to be a four, isn't quick enough or a good enough shooter to be a three. So that's a long-winded way of saying that I'm not super jazzed about any of the rookies in this division, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted T.J. Warren. He's my pick as well because I just want to see if it works. T.J. Warren's a guy that I followed when he was in college, and I really like him. But as you said, I don't know how the game is going to translate. So just as a fan of basketball and NBA basketball, I'm intrigued to see if it can happen because I like it when unusual skill sets work because that just makes the league more interesting. And he played well in summer league, so there's a possibility there. I also like seeing guys who can fit into roles on good teams. It's not a situation where what we thought was going to happen with Julius Randle, where he's going to get some opportunities on a bad team. Of course, now Julius Randle is getting less opportunities on a bad team. But there aren't many rookies in this. The other guy that I feel bad for, another question of how it will work, is Tyler Ennis. But I don't know that we're going to see much of any Tyler Ennis, especially after they got Isaiah.
I mean, they drafted Tyler Ennis because they thought that they could, you know, extract something from the Raptors to get the Canadian kid, and that didn't work out. So I think that's going to go down as probably a miss, just because, as you said, he's the fourth string point guard, and you know, if he's getting playing time, something has gone very wrong.
Interesting that we haven't even mentioned C.J. Wilcox yet. I just think that kind of speaks to the underwhelming logjam of wing options that the Clippers have. You know, they drafted a pretty similar player in Reggie Bullock last year, and he barely got off the bench. Obviously, Jared Dudley's gone, you know, and Matt Barnes, he's aged, obviously, and you know, really didn't have a very good season last year, especially in comparison to his 2012-2013. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with C.J. Wilcox and Reggie Bullock. I had really high hopes for Bullock last season, and obviously didn't turn out well. And, you know, let's hope it goes different for Wilcox.
Though, to be fair, he was starting to get, you know, to build into the rotation. Then he had a pretty bad ankle injury that knocked him out for a couple months. So to some extent, he kind of, you know, got buried. But then when he had the chance to kind of get into the rotation, he did okay for a couple games. And then kind of his rookie season ended up being lost. But I agree with you. That's a curious pick just because, you know, there were some other different, you know, players available at that point which I thought would have been a kind of non-duplicative skill sets, whether it was, you know, Kyle Anderson, KJ McDaniels, someone in that mold who were available, but they decided to, you know, draft the same guy they drafted last year, basically.
Yeah, KJ McDaniels is actually the guy I was just thinking of, and then you mentioned him. You know, he would have offered the Clippers something that, you know, they don't have. They don't have an elite athlete on the wing. You know, he's a developing shooter and ball handler. And, you know, it's remiss to say any rookie is going to come in and be a good defender in the NBA. But he certainly has the physical tools to be a good defender in time once he learns scheme and things like that. He just would have been a far better fit for me. And I think that's another mistake by Doc.
Yeah, I agree, because that's, again, one thing that they're lacking is, other than Matt Barnes, who, as you say, is aging, they lack any kind of person who can defend a bigger wing scorer. I mean, if they ended up trying to guard Kevin Durant with Blake Griffin at times last year, and that, you know, Blake is going to try hard, but that's, you know, you're just asking one of your more dynamic offensive players to get in foul trouble while still getting torched there. And so that's, again, not something they really addressed with any of their offseason moves, whether it was, you know, re-signing Turkoglu or bringing in Douglas Roberts or the draft pick. And so getting even though he's not the tallest, McDaniels is a guy with, you know, the wingspan to maybe be a credible defender on some of those bigger wings for spot minutes, at least.
Are there any other transactions that you guys think are notable that we haven't talked about?
I think we touched on the loss of Channing Frye for Phoenix, and that's going to prove to be pretty big. I think that people who are expecting Markieff Morris to step seamlessly into that role are kidding themselves a little bit. Part of the reason why Frye was so important, and big part of the reason that Goran Dragic had the season he had last year, was that high pick and roll combination. And Markieff Morris had a great season last year, a bounce back season. Big part of that was he stopped trying to be a quote stretch four. He, you know, he cut his 3-point rate in half and you know, became more of kind of a LaMarcus Aldridge mid post type player and was very effective at that. And he's not a guy that is going to be especially efficient, you know, picking and popping at 25 feet from the basket. So already
you've lost a little bit of that from their that what was a really a staple of their offense last year. So and then you know, you go with that, and then that just creates that little bit of extra opening for Dragic to use kind of his, you know, his herky jerkiness to get into the lane and do fun things, and you just wonder how that's going to affect Dragic as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there, Seth. Fry was a huge loss. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he just had a drastic influence on the shooting performances of the other four Suns on the floor. And it makes sense why, as you said, he stretches the floor for everyone, really opens up the paint, pulls an extra defender out. You know, that's something they'll lack this season. And, you know, it's really something that you have to overpay to keep or get. And with Ryan McDonough, his dilemma was, do you pay Channing Frye 4 years, $32 million? Cause that's what he eventually signed for in Orlando. They will certainly, certainly miss him. I agree. Is he worth 4 years and $32 million? I don't think so. So McDonough was kind of put in a tough spot there. Though, like I've been saying, and like you said, they'll certainly miss Frye.
Completely agree on Channing Frye. We've touched on it a little bit, but what I think might be the most impactful thing for the scope of the division long term is just what's happening with Eric Bledsoe, because there is now a distinct possibility that both Bledsoe and Goran Dragic will be unrestricted free agents next summer, and that completely changes the arc of the Phoenix Suns, because if they lose both of them, and it would certainly be a possibility, especially with Bledsoe, should he hit unrestricted free agency, I would expect him to be gone, that it changes what they are, because they have other good players, but you need those guys running the offense and kind of being the engine for the team. And potentially losing both of them is almost catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Goran Dragic said in the past few days, I think, that he's going to opt out of his contract next summer and then quickly re-sign to get more money. But it's obviously a risk anytime any player hits free agency. And as you said, especially with what's going on with Bledsoe, losing both of those guys would be absolutely catastrophic to this team. And not only because they're so talented, but they're kind of the fabric of what Jeff Hornacek has instilled in this group. Like I said earlier, high tempo, really spacing the floor, tons of pick and roll, just attack, attack, attack. Without either of those guys, you know, they really lose that identity. So, yeah, that's certainly something to consider, though I think it's safe to say that Dragic re-signs with Phoenix.
And the other part of that is a big part of the success Phoenix had last year was collectively all of their players, you know, outperformed expectations. And part of that was there was a certain, I don't want to say selflessness, but there was a pretty strong kind of team ethos there. And you wonder, understandably, if a guy is in a bitter, you know, contract situation, that chips away at that a little bit. If Bledsoe is openly agitating to, you know, be the quote unquote the man at point guard and to be paid as such, does that, you know, naturally take away, even if there's no friction between, you know, Dragic and Bledsoe personally, you just wonder that almost has to have an effect on how they play on the court. And, you know, even though they didn't make the playoffs last year, it's that their level of success might be leading to, you know, that the Pat Riley's disease of more, where everyone wants a little bit more. You know, Gerald Green had a great year last year, and now, you know, if he has to take a smaller role this year with Bledsoe healthy and so on and so forth, does he chafe under that? You know, it's worked itself out that Markieff has kind of been dropped into a starting role, but still, is he going to be happy as the fourth option in the starting lineup, or is he going to start to feel that he wants more shots? Not many of those things have to go the other way for there to be some discord and to break down kind of the united team they were last year.
I love that point, and I love that you mentioned the disease of more, especially because, you know, as we've talked about with Dragic and Bledsoe, they're likely free agents next season. The Morris twins are going to be restricted free agents in the summer, and then Gerald Green is also going to be an unrestricted free agent. You know, these guys are in contract years. That stuff matters, you know, especially with, like you said, how harmonious they were last season as kind of Hornacek's first team in a group that kind of came out of nowhere and defied the odds to, you know, nearly make the playoffs. I think they're a definite candidate for aggression, as much as it pains me to say that, because they were so, so fun to watch last year. I'm not totally sold on them being the team in 2014-15 that they were last season.
The other component of that, we talk about the players a lot because that's the easiest way to kind of visualize it, but I think that agents are going to play a factor in that as well, that I think last year it was all these young guys that are years away from free agency, so there wasn't going to be any pressure, but now these guys, not only are they looking contracts in the face, but their agents are, and I could imagine them going to the GM, going to Hornacek and saying, hey, this guy needs to play more, and then them being in the players' ears and fueling the disease of more because they know what's on the table.
And that's not just the guys we talked about. I mean, Alex Len, you know, basically did nothing his rookie season. Now he's in his second year, is his agent. You know, he's now a year away from you know, this, from the contract clock starting to tick on him. Is his agent, or is he kind of, you know, I need to get going here a little bit. I mean, but you know, Miles Plumlee is still there. So now Len gets playing time and Miles Plumlee doesn't. And then suddenly, you know, Plumlee's agent and Plumlee himself are, you know, miffed about that. And so this gets to a kind of a bigger point that I had, a problem that I had with their offseason, is they came into the offseason already with too many dudes, and they've only added more with, you know, picking up Isaiah Thomas and drafting Ennis and Warren, and they have more, you know, guys who probably rightly think they can be productive NBA players than they have kind of rotation slots for those players. And, you know, you never know how much people, what efforts they put forth and what was actually out there in terms of kind of consolidating some of those assets into, you know, one more big ticket item, like, you know, like a Kevin Love, for example, as the primary example. But I think that in some ways they're going to look back at this offseason as a missed opportunity when they could have cashed in on a lot of, you know, as mildly distasteful as it is to use the language of assets when talking about, you know, professionals. But they could have, you know, cashed in and at the peak value of some of these guys. And now, you know, through some of the things we've talked about, though, that value is going to sort of start to eke away as you know, Gerald Green is maybe has a few more kind of temperamental issues this year or something like that. PJ Tucker has a super extreme DUI, and so just the number of ways in which kind of this could be the wheels come off season for them is that's kind of staring us in the face, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, and we'll move on to the season preview part of it. And the first challenge here, Anols, to rank the teams, and we'll do it full health. You can bring in health if you want to. It's your choice. But to rank the teams 1 to 5.
Clippers, Warriors, Suns, who cares? I mean, the Kings and the Lakers are both going to be bad lotto teams, and whether they win 20 or 35 games, I mean, no outcome in there would surprise me terribly for either team. But, I mean, it's hard to predict at this point. That deals with a lot of stuff like motivation and rotation choices and stuff like that, which very difficult to predict at this point. But the top three, I feel like, are going to be in the same order as they were last year.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. I have Clippers, Warriors, Suns, and I really just, you know, I was just grasping at things with my eyes closed, and I came up with Los Angeles and Sacramento in that order, which is a shame because, you know, if the Kings had kept Isaiah Thomas, I'd be just a bit higher on them. Certainly not as a playoff team or anything close to that, but a team that at least has another talented guy, you know, no matter, irrespective of fit. Obviously, he's not a great fit on the team with DeMarcus Cousins and Rudy Gay. But, you know, replacing him with Darren Collison, that certainly wasn't the answer, as we've discussed ad nauseum now. So I have Clippers, Warriors, Suns, Lakers, and then Kings.
You mentioned that about Isaiah Thomas, and something we've soft-sold a little bit almost, is they were a 500 team when those three guys started. Maybe not a playoff team, but that's, you know, in the 40 or so games that they started together, that's the makings of a at least solid team. And with their replacing Thomas with Darren Collison is not that. So I agree with you totally that if they had kept Thomas and everything else had gone the way it did, then they would definitely be a step up from where the Lakers are.
Here's a question for you guys. Is Sacramento's starting backcourt the worst one in the league?
Ooh.
Milwaukee?
Milwaukee. I was thinking Philadelphia just because we don't know who their second starter is going to be.
I'd say the presence of Brandon Knight, as underwhelming as he was last season, makes Milwaukee's backcourt better than Sacramento's.
Point guard Giannis! Point guard Giannis!
Not point guard Giannis.
Yeah.
It's a nice experiment, but as a point guard, he had a quote-unquote point guard, he had a negative assist-to-turnover ratio in Summer League this year. So, you know, that's you kind of see what the thought process is, but I don't think that his game is there. I mean, you know, for what Milwaukee's doing this year, maybe trot him out there and he averages 4.5 turnovers a game, and who cares? And he's gotten some valuable lessons, and then he settles into a nice role as like a Nick Batum type kind of secondary ball handler and playmaker guy, as opposed to a point guard, which is probably asking a little too much.
I'd say it's certainly asking a little too much, though. It was so fun in Vegas watching him jump tip and then immediately receive the ball and initiate offense. That was very, very fun, though. He's not a point guard. I think the Kings, I really hadn't thought about this at all until you mentioned it, Danny. I think they might have the worst starting backcourt in the league.
And when we talk about whatever stat you want to use, if you want to use real plus minus or, you know, whatever, I also think that they're going to probably do worse than that, because defensively, whatever their combination is, presuming it's Stauskas and Collison, they're just going to be abysmal defensively, and the team probably isn't going to be great. So in terms of those kind of stats, I'm guessing that won't help it, especially if they don't have a rim protector behind them, which it looks like they won't.
But hey, they've got a new arena coming, though, so yay.
Well, they do, and they have ownership that apparently might eventually be willing to spend, which is a good thing, because that's going to be – they're going to need to eventually use their cap space as a bludgeon to get teams, and if they have an owner that's willing to spend up to at least the tax to do that, that'll help Sacramento a lot over the years, do what kind of what Utah has done.
Yeah, well, I mean, they noodled around with that this summer with their interest in Josh Smith, which – that actually would have been That would have been a fascinating team with somehow a front court of Rudy Gay, Josh Smith, and Boogie Cousins.
And Rondo.
And Rondo,
Rondo,
yeah.
And Rondo, that's it.
Yeah. Tell me tell me you wouldn't watch that team.
Oh, I would watch that team brick jumper after jumper after jumper.
I would go up and cover them and probably see if I would be able to somehow bring in some sort of adult beverage as I covered them.
Oh, you'd need to. You'd need to.
Well, the terrible jump shot drinking game would you'd be dead by the end of the first quarter.
Yeah, we'd just be hammered in 4 minutes.
No, you'd have a good shot drinking game. You'd switch it around.
Oh, well, then we're not drinking at all.
I think that's part of the 12 steps, actually.
Or maybe you have somebody ring a bell and you alternate between good shots and bad shots. Or like one quarter is good, one quarter is bad, so you can just kind of balance it out.
You have someone ring a cowbell. That's what.
Yes.
There
we go. Okay. Yeah. The next question is, I think with this division, honestly, in my opinion, it's not that hard, but it's how many teams in this division will make the playoffs?
I think it's just the two obvious ones, the Clippers and the Warriors. I've heard some say that the Warriors could be in for a step back, really just given the competitiveness of the Western Conference. And I don't think anyone, you know, any of the three of us see that happening. I think it's the Clippers and the Warriors almost locked in as top six playoff teams, I'd say.
I think that there's a little more of a chance of the Warriors missing the playoffs, but that's mostly not so much Steph, but mostly Bogut's health is something that's been certainly up and down over the years. And if he misses a chunk of time, that's a huge loss for them. And, you know, between that and maybe, Anthony Davis becoming the devourer of worlds, you could see kind of someone else slipping into the playoffs ahead of them. But yeah, the most likely scenario is that the Clippers and Warriors are our top two in this division and make the playoffs and no one else is. I don't think either of us really think Phoenix is a likely playoff team this year.
No.
No, nobody wants to be bold and say all five teams will make the playoffs?
This decade.
I'm not sure this decade.
Me neither. I know that's actually a bold statement to say that before 2020, all five of these teams will have made the playoffs at least once.
I'm really not confident in saying that at all with what we've seen from the Lakers the last 2 years. I'm really, really not at all. So.
I think the Lakers will make it in this decade, but I'm not. The Kings could. I'm not going to say that they can't, but they have to do some things right.
Oh.
And one of those things is not giving Rudy Gay a fat extension next summer.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. So I guess they're not making the playoffs then. And like we talked about earlier, the Lakers are just banking on so much, and, you know, the allure and mystique of, you know, purple and gold to perhaps lure Russell Westbrook or something in 2017. And if that doesn't happen, what are they going to do? Are they ever going to bottom out and try for a high lottery pick? This would have been the year, and they didn't do it.
Well, they probably, you know, thought that they would get the old frozen envelope trick. But... The way back in the you know, NBA lore, the frozen Patrick Ewing lottery pick, which would never happen in this day and age, which would be amazing if it happened in this day and age. But anyway.
You mean like a major market ending up with the number one pick who happened to be from that same major market and just made the Final Four? Sadly, he got hurt after he won MVP, but still.
Yeah. But hey, he sparkled in his rehab assignment this summer. His rehab assignment in the World Cup, which, yeah, let's not talk about that. Pretend it never happened and get to real basketball again, please, quickly.
Yeah, okay, so the last question that I want to go through, though obviously we can go on to other topics if you want, is what player do you think will break out, so meaning they reach another level of either performance, fame, or both? You can choose whatever you want in terms of that.
Huh, let's sprung that one on me a little bit. I think in terms of fame, it's possibly between Dragic and DeAndre Jordan this year, as far as another level as a player. That's an excellent question, and I'm not really sure who I see taking a leap forward just in terms of on court. I mean, I think that the obvious candidate is Klay Thompson, but I am not a believer, so I'm not going to say that. He's certainly the guy who has the most pressure on him this year, given that, you know, you don't trade him for Kevin Love. But I see him as a nice functional role piece as opposed to an actual star. So I think that, you know, Dragic's greatness is going to, you know, be more realized this year. And DeAndre is going to get some, you know, all-star buzz, whether it's deserved or not, if the Clippers come out of the gate really strong this year. I mean, an improving defensive player, rebounding monster. Let's not talk about the free throws, but also just a guy with an immense personality who could probably use a little more exposure for that.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a chance DeAndre makes an all-star team this year. I actually kind of already think of him as someone that has broken out in terms of notoriety and fame. And guy that came to mind for me, though I'm not either. I think it'll really his season will really depend on what Kerr does with the offense, and if he's really intent on putting the ball in Steph's hands as much as he says, and kind of limiting Thompson's influence as a as a ball handler and isolation scorer, unlike what Mark Jackson did, then that'll be a big boon for him. We'll have to see there, though. I'm just from a Warriors perspective specifically, I'm really looking forward to see what Harrison Barnes does this year after a really disappointing sophomore campaign. And his role with the Warriors actually kind of goes back to what I said about Clay's. Will he be a kind of a spot-up shooter, an opportunistic scorer, or will he be, you know, the kind of post-fulcrum and strange, herky-jerky, ineffective isolation scorer that Mark Jackson tried to make him be? I think he's going to be the former under Kerr, and if so, I think, you know, he could really begin to realize his potential that we thought he had after his rookie year as kind of a young two-way wing that has a chance to be a very, very solid contributor on a good team. You know, not necessarily a star that, you know, some people in the Bay Area were talking about after, during, and after Barnes' rookie year. He's the next Paul Pierce. That was
really, simmer down.
That was just ridiculous. I literally see no comparison there whatsoever. But Barnes certainly has the talent to be a solid two-way piece for a very good team, and I want to see that this year.
You guys had really good choices. I'm really happy that neither of mine got taken. I think this is the year that DeMarcus Cousins makes an All-Star game. I think that he's at that level, and I think that a little bit of the stink that was on him in terms of voting and all that might be a little bit cleaned up by FIBA. And then the other guy who I think was really underappreciated last year and was the fourth best player on the Warriors behind Curry, Iguodala, and Bogut is Draymond Green. I think that there's a very meaningful chance that if Kerr is as powerful as I think he's going to be, and that he can say David Lee needs to sit, that Draymond Green is starting at power forward in the playoffs for the Warriors this year. I think that's the logical evolution of this team. I think that he makes sense for that spot since they didn't get Kevin Love. And that would obviously, especially if they could win a playoff series, which I'm not saying they're going to do, but they could, that would be a huge step to be that guy and to basically break the hashtag full squad without breaking up that group.
Draymond Green is arguably my favorite player in the league. I think we've talked about him a lot, Danny. And that's a great point. I hope that happens. The Warriors are obviously best when they spread the floor and are able to, you know, really, really use their speed and versatility on defense to kind of wreak havoc on that end. And those are two attributes that David Lee does not offer. And they are two attributes that Draymond Green really can, especially if he kind of hones his three-point shot this year. But I love Draymond. I'm hoping you're right about that.
I am, too, I'm a Draymond Green fan. I'm just wondering if, in terms of you're talking about breaking out, he's never a guy who's going to put up kind of the quote-unquote numbers that lends itself to that, unless he becomes like the new generation kind of Shane Battier, no-stats all-star, which, you know, it's a, you know, not a ridiculous comparison, actually. But, you know, that was a little bit of lightning in a bottle and Michael Lewis writing about it, which, you know, never hurts. I don't see that exact confluence of factors happening again.
There are enough writers in the Bay Area, though obviously none of Michael Lewis's stature, that I would not be surprised in the slightest if one of them wrote a similar piece about Draymond at some point this year if he actually gets the minutes. And I'm not going to name names, but I know them because I cover the team. But I think it's going to happen. I wrote a piece last year about how he should be starting, and that's kind of where the level is.
Yeah, you and everyone else, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
I like to.
Yeah, I'm not an original.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I mean, not. It's not a knock on you. It's just.
No.
That's kind of analytics 101. Is Draymond Green is much better at basketball than Harrison Barnes.
That was obvious in their rookie years too.
Okay, I feel the need to stand up for David Lee a little bit. I think that the fact that he gets paid too much money is true, but it's sort of a little bit, you know, kind of like Rudy Gay. He's actually a pretty good player. And, you know, there are things that he does on the floor, and I think you missed him, even though, you know, some things happened. I think you guys missed him very badly against San Antonio 2 years ago, for example. And part of the reason I think that he's going to have a nice season with Kerr in charge, because he's a great passer. Like, I legitimately think he's a better passer than Kevin Love. And, you know, if your team that it's doing more movement, then that, you know, his ability to kind of catch the ball in the mid-post area on the move and make a play, he's going to have a really nice season in that role. Yeah, he can't play defense, but, you know, with the offense they should be putting up and the fact they're already pretty good defensively, it'll be fine.
If you can put him in the right spaces, because the other problem is that you need a rim protector next to him, and very few rim protectors can stretch the floor.
Yeah.
So if you're going to let him, like Mark Jackson did, if you're going to let him clog the lane because he's comfortable there, then that's not a good thing. But if you have him a little bit further out and tell him basically do the same thing, he'll be fine. And he'll do that. He's a good team player. He's a nice guy, all that kind of stuff. So, but then you just need to, get him in the right place, and then he'll play from there, and then that won't clog it up as much.
Honestly, if they used him similar to how the Clippers use Griffin a lot in their kind of their, not their half court offense, but their secondary break offense, which is Blake will set a pick and roll at, you know, kind of one elbow and nothing will happen. They'll swing to the other side. Blake will run over to the other elbow, set a pick and roll, and it'll do that three or four times a possession. And that's, you know, really an ideal way to use Lee. Cause then either he catches the, like, he's not, you know, posting up and taking up space, but when he catches the ball, he's catching it on the move at the foul line. And from there, he can, you know, his lack of really deep shooting range isn't that much of a problem, but he can make a play at the rim or make the right pass out of that a lot. And I think that would be a really, you know, clever, excellent use of him, especially if you can, you know, put shooters in either corner.
Well, yeah, and Kerr has kind of alluded to the fact that he's going to do things like that with Lee, basically by just saying that, you know, this is the way the offense is going to go, and I'm extremely high on David Lee. You know, you'd think the next step is, you know, utilizing him that way. Though one of the problems last year was that his jumper just was broken all of a sudden, you know, from 18 feet and in after a really good season in 2013. I think the numbers are far better then, so. We'll see if he shoots a little better, hopefully, this year.
One more question I wanted to ask Seth, and obviously, Jack, you can chime in, is I'm working on a piece now on five-man units and just teams that don't play, and my question is, am I crazy to think that Doc should give some meaningful minutes to just try out Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, and then both of J.J. Redick and Jamal Crawford?
That lineup is such a mess defensively is the problem. And Jamal Crawford's kind of best use is, we can't really run an offense with Chris Paul off the floor, so just throw the ball to Jamal and whatever happens, happens. And maybe tonight's one of the nights where he's going to go crazy. I think I'm much more down on Jamal Crawford as having an actual impact than many. So I don't know. I would very much like to see that lineup. You know, any lineups that involve more J.J. Redick, especially in the fourth quarter, is something that I think the Clippers should take more advantage of this year. With Jamal Crawford as the small forward, I'm less enthused about, though if the only other option is Matt Barnes, because neither Reggie Bullock or CJ Wilcox or Chris Douglas Roberts are ready or able, then that might end up having to happen anyway. So I guess dancing around your question, I'm not wild about that lineup.
And you're, as you said, Danny, Seth, you're more qualified to talk about that at length than I am. But just something to consider, just big picture with that five-man unit, is that the Clippers have never had trouble scoring. You know, they were the best offense in the league last year. And obviously, if you're going to go with a perimeter triumvirate of, you know, Chris Paul, Jamal Crawford, and J.J. Redick, you're doing it for offense. And, you know, a team with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin just doesn't have trouble scoring. Certainly intriguing, and it'd be fun to watch, see if it can be effective at all, though I'm not confident it would be.
And again, I think that the bigger problem kind of down the stretch in games, which I'm transforming that question into not just more minutes, but kind of as a closing lineup. I think one of my bigger problems with Doc's coaching towards the end of last year was kind of the decision that the closing lineup involved Paul and Darren Collison backcourt. And I didn't love that for all the bad reasons we kind of talked about with Darren Collison earlier. And I would like to see a kind of a more balanced lineup, because again, as Jack said, scoring with that lineup, even in late game situations, is never going to be a problem. So getting a little bit extra defense to be able to get those stops in late game situations would be preferable to my mind.
Okay. Any other topics you guys want to impart with the listeners about the Pacific Division?
We touched on a little bit, but just how lucky the NBA got that the Sterling situation wrapped up when it did, and it was not still, even though legally it's still ongoing in terms of control of the team, it was not still ongoing when the Atlanta Hawks, now maybe Cleveland Cavaliers, involved scandals broke. That's just as bad as that situation is going to be, you can only imagine how much worse it would be if they were in the midst of a fight to actively oust Sterling.
Yeah, we know how it can be bad for a league to be dealing with three or four incidents of the same type at the same time.
Yeah. Welcome to the league, Adam.
But I think that's a really good point. And also, the long-term ramifications of potentially, obviously we don't know, just like we don't know how Steve Kerr is going to be as a coach, we don't know how Steve Ballmer will be as an owner, but the possibility of having a stable, non-terrible owner in a marquee area is a huge thing for the league. And the NBA has actually, one of the biggest problems they've had is that they haven't really made that happen anywhere. And getting rid of Sterling is a huge benefit thing that should have happened 20 years ago, and it's going to be a major benefit for the league. And the fact that it's not even going to stay in their family at all, it's going to go to somebody who actively wants to make the team the best it can be, is massive for the league in terms of revenue, let's say 10 years from now.
Yeah, that's hard to argue. And again, we it's not exactly a high bar that Ballmer has to clear to be a better owner on any number of levels. I mean, he certainly, if you've read anything about him or seen anything about him, he certainly has a great passion for the team. The question is whether, like so many newer owners, that passion kind of transforms into maybe being more hands-on than is really warranted with respect to his kind of his, you know, basketball expertise and acumen. That remains to be seen, though even with a little bit of, I guess, quote unquote meddling, would still be better than Sterling, who wasn't averse to certain kinds of meddling on his own in terms of, you know, getting involved with nixing various deals for financial reasons or what have you.
Thank you guys so much for taking the time.
Yeah, guys.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to both Jack and Seth for coming on. You can read Jack Winter in Dime Magazine or dimemag.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Armstrong Winter. That's ArmstrongWinter. And you can read Seth at Hoop365, Clipper Blog, and the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network. You can follow him on Twitter at SethPartnow. It was a pleasure having them on. Around the same time, I'm also going to do another encapsulation, this time of the Atlantic Division, so go from one coast to the other coast, and very excited with that. That might be out by the time you listen to this, so I encourage you to go that way, and if you've already listened to that one, thank you so much. As I always say, I really appreciate any insight that you can provide, whether positive, negative, whatever. It makes the show better. You can email me at daniel.larue@realgm.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter at daniellaroux. That's DannyLeroux. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.